This is The Guardian.
Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Unbridled joy at St James's Park. There won't be many Champions League games where Dan Burns scores more than Kylian Mbappe, when Sean Longstaff dominates the midfield, and when Fabian Schär sticks one in the top corner in injury time while falling on his arse. We'll praise Eddie Howe, wonder what it all means for PSG, while of course remembering the geopolitics of it all. Same goes for Man City, of course. Winning in Leipzig, Rico Lewis suggests he might be worth a look for England with a brilliant display in midfield. Julian Alvarez, once again the centre forward with the answers. Elsewhere, Groundhog Day for Celtic as they lose late on to Lazio. We'll look ahead to the Premier League weekend, discuss Jurgen Klopp asking, but not really asking, for a replay with Spurs, celebrate FIFA giving the 2030 World Cup to Czech notes six countries in two different continents. We'll take your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Nicky Bandini, welcome.
Morning.
Philippe Auclair, bonjour, ça va?
Ça va, bonjour à toi.
Yes. Mark Langdon, hello.
Hi, Max.
Let's start St James's Park. Cahoon says, as one of the few remaining listeners from the evil Club City, please can you talk about Miggy and Fab for at least 10 seconds? Alex says, can you please talk about Sean Longstaff for the full hour? And Chris says, as your only Newcastle listener, can you please acknowledge the insane job Howe has done? Lascelles was our captain in the Championship. Six of our seven players wouldn't be taken by any other Premier League club. He's taken us from the bottom of the league to smashing PSG in 2 years. It's the first time they've hosted a Champions League game in 20 years. Their biggest win in the competition proper, I think, in the Philippe Auclair derby. It's a fairy tale, right, for them to hammer PSG with goals from these local boys and share in the last minute, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'll let Philippe maybe dispel the fairy tale aspect of it. But if, you know, in terms of how that played out just last night with, as one of the listeners said there, you know, Lascelles, Dan Burn, Longstaff, I don't think that there would be a long queue for those players from other Premier League teams. And the way that they played last night against PSG was fantastic. I think that is full credit to Eddie Howe, the bravery that they showed to really push up on Paris and make the game uncomfortable for them, roared on by the crowd. It kind of worked perfectly together where, the crowd was so pumped up. Every tackle was being cheered as if it was a goal. They were aggressive when they needed to be aggressive without overstepping the mark, and then took their chances fantastically well. And the goal scorers, you know, three of those, you just really would have struggled to have guessed. I mean, Almiron, scored a lovely goal last week, wasn't it? So he's in good form. But the others, Longstaff and Burn, both Newcastle supporters. Burn, you know, I think it's well documented, his family sort of been season ticket holders, and he was let go by the club when he was a kid, and he's sort of gone full circle and back there. I mean, those are great moments, and they're now in control of the most difficult Champions League group. They've sorted out their Premier League form. They've knocked Man City out of the League Cup. The season's looking good for them.
Mm. Dan Burn wanted that header so much, Nicky, didn't he? And he said, look, crazy, it's not sunk in. I'm speechless. Playing for Darlington, you're just trying to survive at that level and get a pro contract. I've had an up and down career, so just to play Champions League football, I'm just very, very proud. Before we go to Philippe, I mean, it is his grin was beautiful to watch.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of beauty in this, and I think I'm going to agree with a bunch of what Philippe says as well. But I think it's it feels like two completely parallel stories in my mind at this point, because there's the ugly story, which is about ownership and which is about things that go on above the sort of level of the players, things they don't control, things fans don't control. And there's the part of it that's fandom, that's football, that's the reality of people's lives. And Dan Byrne talking about getting released by Fulham at 25 years old in that conversation as well, and here he is scoring for his club, not any club, his club, in the Champions League against PSG, who have the best player in the world playing for them. It's an astonishing story. And look, you know, I've just come back from Naples watching Napoli play against Real Madrid, and that's a city that I think has such a unique relationship with football and has such a unique relationship with having one club that dominates everything. And there's such a parallel, I think, for me there with having just seen that. And I wasn't in Newcastle for this game, but I definitely feel like you can relate to that absolute all-consuming fandom. A story popped into my mind just this morning as I was coming up. I've just come into Guardian Towers. I'm doing this in the Guardian offices and coming up on the train. And I remember going to Newcastle all the way back in, this is going to age me, but 2003-04, I was a student. I went to Newcastle. It was one of the first times I'd been up to Newcastle. And I was out with a friend, and Newcastle were playing against Marseille in the UEFA Cup, as it was then. And I remember seeing this couple, and it was kind of awful, but fascinating at the same time, because this couple went out and you had, and this is also like a very sexed conversation, which I think is not representative. There's lots of women who support Newcastle as well, but it was a guy and a girl, and the guy was wearing a Newcastle top with the stripes on, and she was dressed up to the nines. They were clearly on a date, but the game was on in the pub they were in. And for 45 minutes, he sat and watched the screen and did not say a word to her. And then at halftime, they spoke. And then the game came on again and he watched again. And I just, you know, look, again, I kind of didn't want to tell that story because it sounds very gendered and it shouldn't be, right? Because 100%, I know women who support Newcastle. There are lots of women who support Newcastle and are just as involved. But that feeling that I remembered of him watching that game in the UEFA Cup and how all-consuming it clearly was for him back then just came back to me now. Because it's the Champions League, it's Paris Saint-Germain, it's Newcastle, and that all-consuming feeling deserves to be as great as this, deserves to be as fun as this, and it's not going to get better than winning 4-1 against Paris Saint-Germain at home.
Yeah. And actually, Philippe, Eddie Howe looks like he could have done it without any financial input from anyone, right? Like, he's taking players who are, I mean, at best, I mean, ordinary is not fair, is it? And like, you can improve as a footballer. You know, as Nicky says a lot of times, you shouldn't just judge someone as this is Dan Byrne and this is how good he is. But even still, on this stage, to get this out of that team is so impressive.
It is very impressive. And I mean, even though there are some absolutely superb players, I mean, Alexander Isak is one of them. Bruno Guimaraes is a top player. But the way that you see players like Almiron, or players like Fabian Scher, who would have had Fabian Scher doing, I mean, the performance last night was absolutely, I mean, extraordinary, majestic almost, which is not the word that normally would associate with Fabian Scher. So I don't think that this has ever been in any doubt that Eddie Howe was a very fine manager indeed. And he proved it last year, took them to the Champions League. I don't think there's any of us who was expecting them to do that, even though they had been a huge outlay of money. I mean, they spent more than 200 million net in 2022. And similarly, you know, by the way, Bournemouth also had spent tons of money when Maxime Demin was the owner. But you can throw money at a football club and the team does nothing, which is, by the way, what the guys on the other side were demonstrated quite magnificently. More about them in a minute. But you can, I mean, it's totally possible, as I said, as Antoniki said, it's like two parallel universes. You remember, Max, we said that it was totally possible to feel complete joy, for example, when Saudi Arabia beat Argentina in the World Cup, and to think this was marvelous for the Saudi people, because there's a huge difference. A country is not a regime. That's and the problem with Newcastle is that we actually, the borders are blurred here, because on one hand, Newcastle is a proper football town. People are passionate about their club and so on, as Nicky has, you know, so beautifully described. But this is actually different. But it's possible to acknowledge the excellence of the work he's done. And also the huge role, obviously, that the crowd played in that game. It's very funny because for me it was a bit like a reverse image of what happened in Lens, between Lens and Arsenal, where you had a team which actually hadn't started the season well, which was the case of Lens, had done extremely well last season, which was the case of Lens and Newcastle, supported by a public, a crowd that hadn't seen European football for quite a while, absolutely passionate, two proper football cities, and in front of them, two teams who were actually surprised, I think, by the hostility and the fire that was not only in the stands, but also seemed to seep down from the stands and be swallowed whole by those players who became different, and which is rather beautiful. I mean, of course, what was missing is that when Burns scored, he should have taken his shirt off and we should have a portrait of Mohammed bin Salman underneath or something like that. Or they should have done a dance like Ronaldo did on Saturday day by the corner flag. And this didn't happen.
Mark, you sort of think that sort of Sunday league chat about wanting it more feels so ridiculous at this level of football. But it's linked to the crowd as well, I know. But like, you did feel that they wanted it a bit more. I mean, there's other parts to the game, of course, but that is a big part of this.
It felt like it mattered more to Newcastle. I mean, even at the end of the game, Mbappe was shrugging his shoulders, unable.
The first
really
Frenchman
to, as he was walking off the pitch. he was playing up to the trademark there. I think there was some of that, but I also, if we're sort of looking at it maybe from the PSG angle, when the team came through, I was very surprised that Luis Enrique had moved away from the kind of 4-3-3 formation that he'd been using, and Vitinha had been dropped to the bench, and they had four forwards on the pitch, Muani and Dembele, Ramos and Mbappe, which in some ways is brave from Luis Enrique, but they had nobody to get the ball to those players. And every time they tried to build up from the back, it felt like they were a player short because Mbappe doesn't come deep. He's not a sort of natural number 10. Muani and Dembele are only thinking about going forwards. They were unable to build up in a kind of normal way. And so I felt that Luis Enrique played into Newcastle's hands as well. And you know, that encouragement they got from the Marquinhos sort of sloppy ball out. But he did that because he didn't have enough players in midfield to actually play to. That meant that Newcastle just stepped onto PSG even more. One other Newcastle player that we haven't mentioned, I thought Anthony Gordon probably just epitomises kind of that Newcastle performance. Just ran around and gave everything for, I think he was substituted right, it was 92, 93 minutes. But, you know, he was somebody that was being mocked when Newcastle paid the money that they did for him. He then had a very good European under-21 championship and seems to be really sort of growing into that position in the Newcastle front three. Yes, I think Newcastle wanted it more, but I do think if Luis Enrique had his time again, he would have picked a different team.
Maybe there's a third track to this story, without wanting to sort of go too quickly from what Newcastle did right to what PSG did wrong. I mean, this 4-2-4 was nonsense. Trying to get away with that sort of approach, playing with four attackers in your team, trying to think you're going to play with a team that light in such a raucous and on top of you atmosphere, and when you know you're going to get pressed, you know you're going to give your defenders aren't going to have much time on the ball and they're going to need to release it quickly, and they haven't got options in midfield to do that because you've got so many forwards on the pitch. I think it was a crazy team selection by Luis Enrique and definitely punished.
He was actually asked, Nicky, about the tactics after the game, and his response was sibylline, not sublime, sibylline. And because he was asked, you know, what about the tactics? Don't you think they were responsible for the defeat? And he said, I am the first person responsible for the result, the first and last person responsible for that. Can you explain tactically how you set up? Well, we played with the same system during the whole game, was the only thing he said about it, which is extraordinary. And he said there was no problem with the attitude of my players. You probably saw another game. We had an optimist and we were looking forward. The result is fair, but the scoreline doesn't reflect what we saw. I'm happy with what my players have done. I mean, it was quite extraordinary. I know he can be like that. He's not really the most open of managers, and he's also, he takes a while to, he chooses not to say anything to his players after games because he feels he's too emotional. So he was still probably, in a way, distilling what he wanted to tell them. But I have to say the comments in the French media this morning, be it the press or the radio or television or social networks, the finger is pointed at players like Mbappé and Colomwani, but especially at Luis Enrique, because to be honest, we were starting to see, we were talking 2 weeks ago about PSG, which was starting to take shape. With yeah, Virginia,
worrying.
By
it
the
was
way,
worrying. Yeah.
It was worrying, and they had a midfield, and they had, you know, they had, it made sense. Players were coming back into in good shape and so forth. But the thing as well, the players didn't react when they must have realized they were in a bit of a pickle in that atmosphere with players in front of them who were clearly inspired by the occasion. But there was no reaction from Luis Enrique. That's also very strange. There was no attempt to actually rejig his team or to change a few things. They carry on playing the same way. And in a way, I think what Eddie Howe had done, he watched obviously PSG very intently, what they've done with Enrique. And he saw that it was a team that did commit mistakes when it was put under pressure. And they were very good at doing that and very good at exploiting that. And maybe they were a bit lucky with a few things. You think, well, what if Dembele's chance goes in at the, you know, to start with? What is Marquinhos doing, even if he doesn't have a midfield player to pass on to? Will Fabian Schär ever score another goal like this? honestly, his two legs are about 1 yard apart, which is not the way that my coach was telling me to shoot, but there you go. But it's beautiful. And also, Schär winning the... This said... That goal, and I, you know, please talk about it, Max, because it was a beauty, but was absolutely, was an exemplar of what the game was about. A, it's a player jumping from his central defensive position to win the ball in midfield, carrying on forward, exchanging a 1-2, and then lodging in the top corner. This is not going to happen every night, is it?
Also in this group then, Dortmund 0, Milan 0, two goalless draws. Not an ideal start for Milan, Nikki.
No, I think this actually has put them a bit behind the eight ball. And I think there's a real frustration at Milan because they've created lots of chances across these two games. Certainly in the first half of this game, you could say that Dortmund created some chances as well. I think Marlon started the game really well. But by the end, when you looked at the sort of the balance sheet, as it were, there was a chance for Giroud in the first half that he really, really should put on target. He's so close to goal and he manages to hook it over. There was one for Chukwueze in the second half where he was just absolutely, or really had time to get his feet right and shoot with the goal at his mercy and didn't do that, got his feet all wrong. They've had 39 shots across these two games against Newcastle and Dortmund did not manage to put the ball in the net. And I think there's a real feeling that this could easily be 6 points and instead it's 2 points. And in this group, that's potentially a problem. Now, the thing which I think I said after the first game when Milan drew at home is, of course, it's a better result for Newcastle than it is for Milan because it's a draw away from home for Newcastle. But I said it's not necessarily a disaster for Milan because I think that there's actually, despite this being the group of death, there's some teams in it that are more flawed than people realise. And I think Dortmund in this game defensively were all over the place. And I think that is the flaw they have. We've seen Paris Saint-Germain's flaws against Newcastle. So there are flaws there in other teams. But Milan have to show they can punish them, and Milan have their own flaws. And that's why Newcastle are now in a very strong position in this group. Huge win for them. And I think everyone else is going to be fighting for that second spot, possibly. But the two games now, back-to-back PSG against Milan, are probably going to determine which of those two teams is in a position to fight for one of those qualifying spots.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with...
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Manchester City's win in Leipzig. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We're going on tour. We're in London. Philippe is there with me and Barry, Troy Townsend, Ellis James on the 13th of November. John Bruin, Nader Manuaha, and the Will Unwin Anecdote in Manchester on the 15th. Of course, Mark Nandon and Nicky's shows all sold out, but you can watch the Brighton show with Nicky and Johnny Lou on the internet. It'll be available for a week after we've finished as well. So go to theguardian.com/FWTour23 and buy your tickets. RB Leipzig 1, Manchester City 3. I mean, I thought Rico Lewis, Mark, was the story of this game for me. If I you try and look at a Man City win and go, okay, what's new, what's different? When we saw the team sheets, we're like, oh, he's probably playing in midfield. And he was just a total joy.
Yeah, they didn't miss Kevin De Bruyne. They didn't, it was a different type of performance. It was more like a Foden type, the way that he was getting the ball in tight spaces and, finding teammates or sort of beating the Leipzig press. When I saw the team sheet, I thought he was going to play as a defensive midfielder, and maybe Guardiola was thinking, well, Rodri's out of the Arsenal game. It didn't work against Wolves. Could Rico Lewis play in Rodri's position? Because when he'd previously been in the team, he would move into that kind of defensive midfield position, usually from the fullback area. But he was so much more than, just a defensive midfielder. In fact, he was City's biggest threat. He was involved in basically everything that they did well. Guardiola does like to hype up players, and so you sort of take what he says with a pinch of salt. He admitted that himself, didn't he, the other week with Nunez, when he said, oh, actually, I called him one of the best players in the world. I didn't actually mean it. but he has been sort of glowing about Lewis for a long time, even last season when he was putting him in the team. And there were question marks as to why he was doing that. He was adamant that he was good enough to play for Manchester City, and he would be a star. And this was sort of a big step along that way. I suppose the problem is, when will we see him next? I mean, could he play him against Arsenal, or do we have to wait sort of 2, 3, 4 weeks to see him play again? On that evidence, you would say he could definitely step in and play instead of Nunez or Kovacic or any of those Man City players, because he was brilliant.
I mean, De Bruyne is injured. Rodri suspended against Arsenal. You see the performance. I mean, it's just...
I mean, I suppose it shouldn't, Philippe, be a surprise that someone who's got into Man City's 25 is good at football, right? Like that sort of feels like a given.
But that good is... it's pretty damn amazing. And if I ever hear again that England is missing talented midfielders, that's it. I've had it with this. This is terrifying. The only thing, the one you have to feel for is Calvin Phillips, because good luck to you, my friend, with this boy actually being able to play in that position. But the thing, actually, Guardiola after the game said the only thing he misses is a bit of height. That's the problem. But that he can basically play in almost any position, which makes him the perfect Guardiola player. Also because he has the tactical intelligence to fit in any position. It's just that, not just that he's got the technique. And by the way, I absolutely love the way he carries the ball. Some players have got this almost effortless way of carrying the ball as if they never need to look at it, ever. And he's one of those. It's absolutely glorious to watch.
Feel like Pep has got quite a lot out of some short players in the past.
Yes.
And some players with a low centre of gravity are quite good, aren't they? And I guess the thing is, Nicky, from a Leipzig point of view, is you can be good for 20 minutes, right? They didn't get a kick in the first half. Then they came out of the traps, they scored, and you thought, oh, hello, this is interesting. They sort of did the similar thing last year, because these guys play each other every year. But then suddenly, out of nowhere, Alvarez, who is really just kind of slowly but surely being... Is it slowly? Surely he hasn't won the World Cup. That's not that slowly, is it?
Not slowly.
Quickly and surely, it's just proving that he is also good. I mean, Haaland gets all the headlines, but, Alvarez is wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, Alvarez is a brilliant footballer. On Leipzig, I think you're dead right. There's like fascinating sort of parallel actually coming from talking about the Newcastle game to talking about this one, because actually you can... shows what you can do with statistics. Like, if you looked at just the possession numbers for this game and the Newcastle PSG going, they look quite similar, except PSG have the possession against Newcastle and Man City have the possession against Leipzig. And you see what a difference that can mean in terms of control of the game, how much possession you have. Because, yeah, I think Leipzig had to play this for at best a 20-minute spell or for taking the chances where they could. And Dependa did take that goal really well. I thought his little sort of shoulder barge into the defender before he scores felt personal. You know, it was a real, like, out of my way, I'm doing this. And at that moment, you think, okay, maybe this team's got that cynicism about it and knows how to get a result here. But City are just too good, aren't they? And as you say, Alvarez is a outrageously good talent to not be the top talent at a club, frankly. And now Rico Lewis as well. I don't know, Max, because of course, not everyone who listens will know this, but when we did Stan on Tuesday and Bellingham scored, I remember your first reaction then was to talk about how many World Cups Bellingham was going to win for England. So how many is it now with Rico Lewis as well?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, actually, Mark. Like, Southgate names his squad today. I mean, he'll have probably watched that game. Might seem quick, but you sort of think, it might be worth looking at, right? We're wondering who's, you know, surely Rico Lewis is a better bet than Henderson now.
Max, I'm nervous about talking about England squads because the last time you asked me a question about an England squad that was announced on the same day, it was about Ivan Toney, and I said, "Oh no, Southgate won't pick him because of all the issue." And he did, and it aged not the best. So I'll sit on the fence as to whether Rico Lewis should be in at this point. I think if he plays even semi-regularly for Manchester City between now and the end of the season, playing at the level that he has, then there is an obvious spot for him in what, you know, within that midfield, because I don't see how you can keep picking Phillips if, you know, if he's just not playing for what would be two seasons. And Henderson, you know, is playing in a league that is not going to put him in the best shape for a European Championship. I mean, it's only one game and, you know, consistency and getting in that City team is very difficult, but the talent is obvious.
Abu Dhabi beat the fizzy drinks. You know, just worth because I can see Newcastle fans going, hang on a second, you talked about Saudi Arabia when we won, you don't talk about Abu Dhabi with Manchester City. It's worth, if you're going to emphasise it once, you should at least be consistent. Also in this group, a 2-2 draw between Red Star Belgrade and Young Boys. Fred says, now we've done City and Newcastle, we've seen Arsenal and Manchester United yesterday. The question of the week, I think, how would Mark rank the four English Champions League team performances in terms of sausages this week? Over to you, Mark.
Well, there's a sporting saying, isn't there, about you don't care how the sausage was made as long as it tastes good. Sort of, I suppose that would be the Mourinho way of thinking about football more than Pep Guardiola. So I've had to think about this one. So I've gone for Manchester City as the Greg sausage roll in all of this, because it doesn't matter where you are, it kind of always tastes the same. You know, it's very consistent. You know, you don't mind it, but maybe it's getting a little bit boring now. So I've gone for that. I think Newcastle it would be my favourite sausage, which is the honey and mustard one. You know, a butcher's honey and mustard sausage.
Yeah, okay.
You've got the sweetness of those strikes, the hotness of the crowd as well. So I think the honey and mustard works well for that. Arsenal, I've gone for a sausage in batter that you get from, say, a fish and chip shop, because it started off quite well. When I have the first couple of bites of a sausage in batter, I think, okay, you know, this is good. The more you eat of it, the kind of stodgier it gets. And then the after effects are not the best. And, you know, Saka's injury maybe sort of plays into that. And Manchester United, I've gone for one of the most disgusting pieces of meat that I've ever eaten. And that was a turkey sausage. I was in Orlando in one of those breakfast buffets that Philippe absolutely hates, as he references in the book. And I didn't realise it was a turkey sausage. And I mean, that does not taste like a good sausage to me, Max. And, you know, Manchester United.
I thought maybe Manchester United is a kind of, it's a really great sausage, but it's one that you left in the oven overnight. And then and then you come back and you think, might still be all right. You know, and then, you know, and it cost a lot of money, right? It did cost a lot of money. It used to be great, and now it's just... leathery and falling apart. And
no, I think we have to pay homage to Mark's astonishing knowledge of world sausages, because we were talking about this before we started recording, and I said, what would be PSG's sausage? And Mark got it first time, no cue, whatever. It says it's andouillette. Now, if you've never had andouillette, and if you're not French, and if you buy supermarket andouillette, I won't say anything more. You won't think that you're preparing it in the kitchen. I think you're preparing it in that other place. Right. So I wanted to give...
Are they popular?
They're very popular. And when they're properly made, they're absolutely astonishingly delightful and wonderful. But unfortunately, most of them aren't. But I mean, I had to salute Mark's extraordinary knowledge of the sausage world. It's fantastic.
There's nothing Mark doesn't know about meat. Let's be honest about this. I wasn't surprised. I would have been surprised if he hadn't known, to be brutally honest. To Group E, Atleti and Lazio are tied on 4 points, Feyenoord on 3, Celtic. Once again, 0 points. They lost 2-1 at home to Lazio. Now, Fergie says, why is every single one of Celtic's Champions League games the same? Play fairly well, create chances that we don't take, give away sloppy goals, lose. I'm starting to get quite disheartened by the same thing year after year with no change. It's heartbreaking, Nicky, isn't it? Because not only did they go ahead with a lovely goal, they also had that goal disallowed for offside. The guy celebrated for about 25 minutes. You're like, oh. And then right at the death, one of those headers that takes an hour to go in.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually, there's a parallel opposite universe that Lazio are living in, where they play badly and then score in the 95th minute. Because, of course, it was a goalkeeper goal from Provadel that got them the draw against Atletico in the first round. And here, Pedro in the 95th minute gets them the win. And I'm not convinced. I mean, this is... You know, the reality of football and the reality of a group stage and draws and how much difference that makes in terms of your prospects. But comparing Milan and Lazio's performances from the Italian perspective in the Champions League, it's night and day. Milan is vastly superior, yet Lazio are now in a good position in their group with 4 points, and Milan have 2 points and are struggling because of their opponents and because in the end sticking the ball in the net is quite important. I think a moment of just Champions League sort of familiarity, I suppose, for Pedro, who did turn down Saudi money in the summer to hang around and play this season in the Champions League. So, very cruel on Celtic. I thought they were the better team in this game. I thought that first goal was such a really well-constructed goal with them building up to Firashi putting it in. I thought Brendan Rodgers got some things right tactically. I thought that the press was putting Lazio under... some real difficulty in large parts of this game, and it felt like there was this sort of fairly aimless game plan from Lazio of just getting those long balls into Immobile, who hasn't looked good all season, really. Which isn't to say Celtic were brilliant, because they weren't, but I thought they were the better of the two teams for big parts of the game, and no reward for it in the end.
Also in this group, Atleti beat Feyenoord 3-2. It's nice to see Morata scoring goals, Philippe, isn't it? You know, just sort of smiling, not looking bereft like he was at Chelsea.
And the second one, my goodness, that is some goal, by the way. It is absolutely...
What a cross,
We've talked with Sid about Morata, and it is rather lovely to see this player who has this droopy-like expression, has had it for his whole career, and then suddenly he seems to have found a place where he can fully express himself. But there were a couple of other players, I thought, in that game who were... reminded us of how splendid they were. I think Antoine Griezmann, again. I mean, how often have you said that? And it's not just for his goal, which is, you know, really, really smart. I don't know if there's a more intelligent player than Antoine Griezmann in world football, to be honest, but wherever he plays, the influence he had. And the other, because we used to speak about him as the best goalkeeper in the world, and then for some reason, he's gone off the radar a little bit. But Oblak, my goodness, he had some game last night. And it was actually terrifically entertaining, which is not exactly perhaps what we were expecting from an Atletico Feyenoord game.
Mm. In Group H, Barca won 1-0 at Porto. I suppose the big controversy of this game, Mark, was the handball. Cancelo handballs it in the box, gives away a penalty, which is given by Anthony Taylor, I think. And but then they see that a Porto player has handled it just
before. Keogh.
Yeah, and he's... To me, he's controlled it on his sort of upper left pec shoulder.
Yeah, so first thing to say is that although Anthony Anthony Taylor was ref. It wasn't an English person on VAR with him, so we can't put the boot in there.
Was it Duranio Inglaterra?
I'm not sure what the communication was like. I felt like I know that Philippe disagrees, but I did feel like it was handball. Now, whether it was clear and obvious error to overrule it, I'm not so sure. But it was the way that the ball kind of came down off of that, what would have been a chest control. It felt more natural for it to have been used by the arm, in my opinion. But it felt 50-50. And I think there are, you know, many people that sort of, you know, are angry at VAR for meddling, I suppose, in what would be, you know, just those 50-50 calls that you're not quite sure of. And that was maybe one of those.
Also in this Barca game, Philippe, the tackle by Jules Koundé.
Yes, I still don't know. I've watched it about 10 times, how he does that, because he's behind the attacker. He's not in the right position. And he manages to put a tackle with his foot off the ground and with the studs to push the ball away from the attacker, who is about to basically to score. And I think at the moment, first reaction is, oh, that's a pen. That's a pen. Then you see Koundé's reaction, who is screaming like he's scored the winner in a World Cup final. You realize, no, I've just actually seen one of the greatest tackles I will see this year. And you know what? Deschamps uses him at right back. I had to say that. I mean, when you see what he can do at centre back, he's just one of the very, very, very best. But there you go. Yeah,
Pepe's a star.
Pepe doesn't believe it.
He kind of doesn't get the shot away. And Koundé had already been yellow carded. It was inside the penalty box, so it could have been a kind of disaster moment for him, where he gives away a penalty and gets sent off, and then probably Barca don't win the game, maybe even lose it. But it was definitely a goal-saving tackle for sure.
Incredible game in Antwerp. They were 2-0 up against Shakhtar, ended up losing 3-2. Toby Alderweireld had a chance to make it 3-3, missed a penalty in the last minute. As we've said before, an incredible achievement for Shakhtar to be in this competition. They don't get to play their home games in their home ground, of course. So I think not a lot of people expected them to get many points. So to get their first win on the board and still be in contention is a great achievement. Before we move on from part two, some very sad news from Leighton Orient. A lot of you got in touch on Tuesday night. The fan who was attended to for a medical emergency during their game with Lincoln has passed away. He was 74-year-old Derek Reynolds. He received treatment in the East Stand. 20 fans had to run onto the pitch to alert the ref about the incident, to try and get him to halt the game. There was some miscommunication. I think the ref tried to start the game again and fans were desperately trying to say, listen, stop the game. The game is abandoned eventually. Leighton Orient said Derek was a lifelong O's supporter. He lived in Osborne Road, a short walk from the ground, for many years. As well as being a lifelong fan, Derek was heavily involved in the club and managed the club's tannoy system during the 90s. They will pay tribute to Derek on Saturday ahead of their game against Reading. And that'll do for part two. We'll look ahead to the Premier League games in part three.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Before we look ahead to Arsenal-Man City, we should probably talk about Jurgen Klopp in this press conference ahead of the Europa League game, which may have happened against Union Saint-Gilloise before you listen to this pod. Oncoming Storm says, what's more embarrassing, Klopp saying the Spurs game should be replayed or Barry on a train in Munich? K-Mam says, if Mark could go back and replay eating a vegetable he disliked and replace it for one he'd prefer, what would that be? I mean, for balance, after tweeting that, I tweeted that I thought it was very unhelpful of Klopp to say he wanted a replay. A lot of people said I needed to give my head a wobble and that I was a complete moron. He said something like, this has never happened, so that's why I think a replay is the right thing to do. I'm not angry with anybody at all. They made a mistake. They felt horrible that night. I'm 100% sure that's enough for me. Nobody needs further punishment. It feels, Nicky, really it feels to me unhelpful. And it feels to me that although this is a different kind of mistake and an unprecedented mistake, there's no real difference between the fact that Liverpool should have been one up in this game in the same way that when Brentford equalised against Arsenal last year, it should have been offside and it wasn't because they drew the lines on the wrong player or something. And Arsenal should have remained one up. I can't see a tangible difference, but I may be a moron who needs to give my head a wobble.
I think we can acknowledge difference in the circumstance of it. There is difference in the fact that there were people in that officiating crew who knew in real time that this decision was wrong and it didn't get applied. That is a situation without much comparison that I can reach for. I also think I'm very willing to understand the depth of sentiment about this because, first of all, because Premier League title races have become completely stupid and the pace you're expected to keep up with Manchester City is so extreme that you know that dropping points anywhere can hurt you so severely. It feels like overwhelming, which I think is part of why the reaction to this can feel extreme. I also remember really vividly when Italy got knocked out of the World Cup by South Korea and the sort of genuine feeling after that whole sort of fiasco with infamously bad refereeing and genuine feeling in Italy that there needed to be political consequences, like there needed to be consequences with FIFA, this needed to be acknowledged, it needed to be. So I understand that feeling of, oh, we've been robbed and something awful has happened and having a reaction to it. And I think it's worth saying as well that Klopp does sort of say in those quotes that on the one hand, maybe there should be a replay. On the other hand, I don't think that will happen. He doesn't say I'm sort of demanding this and I expect it to happen. So I think it's worth sort of like, I'm trying to be balanced about it because I think sometimes like on Twitter, everything just gets cut to 5 seconds of something and then shout about it rather than to actually sort of acknowledge all that context. Having said all that, do I think there should be a replay? No, because I think you open up such a gigantic can of worms at that point that I think you will lead us down a path of more and more acrimony, more and more argument, more and more sort of, well, they got that and so we should get this, that goes on forever. So I think it's not practical to have a replay. But I understand the depth of upset. I understand why people feel genuinely like they've been cheated out of something. And the one thing I would say is like the counter to it is I do remember, and it's different because this is a question of sportsmanship rather than a question of a rule being broken. But I do remember Arsenal against Sheffield United in the cup and Wenger saying, no, like we have to have a replay because we scored a goal when they weren't really playing. Like when they'd sort of, there was that, the ball was kicked out and they thought Arsenal were going to play it back to them and they didn't. So there is some precedent for clubs going, hang on, I'm not happy and let's fix it. But I do think that in this case, I don't know, I think that the damage you could do by creating that precedent for replaying games is bigger than perhaps people have really even acknowledged.
There is nothing in the regulations that would allow for this game to be replayed. Beginning of story, end of story. But my eternal gratitude for Nicky for dealing beautifully with this mine which had been found on the beach somewhere on Merseyside, which you diffused, finding the green cable and the red cable and cutting them exactly how they should be cut to avoid another flare-up or explosion. But there's no, I mean, give me one example, the excerpt of the statutes, regulations of Premier League, where this would be actually taken care of. There's none. So forget about it.
I suppose that Arsenal-Sheffield United game is the one example I could think of where, like, if the clubs agree something.
It was the winning team which actually came and said, you know, that's not on. I think Marcelo Bielsa as well at some point was talking about replaying a game and other.
So Ange could do it. I mean, Ange is a great bloke. He could do it, couldn't he?
Yeah, Ange could do it. I mean, if Tottenham were to say, oh, we want to replay that game.
There's two people on the Zoom going, yeah, you're all right, mate.
Why not? You know, feel free, gentlemen, you know, to do it. But I somehow doubt it's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, just on that, obviously it was the Arsenal incident was kind of seen as an Arsenal
yes.
error, faux pas, bad sportsmanship rather than kind of any anything, you know, on this occasion really had nothing to do with Tottenham. I just think back to the question about replaying a moment. I did once eat a parsnip that I thought was a potato wedge from the work canteen. And
you could turn back the clock at any moment in your life. It would be that. As Liverpool go to Brighton, which should be a very interesting game. The game of the weekend is Arsenal Man City. I've got two Arsenal supporters on this Zoom. Nikki, how do you feel about it?
Oh, horrified, terrified, scared, of course. All the normal things that a fan should feel before their team plays in a big game. Of course, I'm extra worried about Saka, obviously, after what happened in midweek with him going out of the game. I feel like Arteta's sort of insistence that top players should just be able to play 70 games is something I struggle to go along with. I think there needs to be some acknowledgement of tiredness. But obviously, in this game, you just want him there. And obviously, I hope he's okay. But no, how would you not be scared of playing this Manchester City team? They're a juggernaut, even if they have shown this season they're not completely invulnerable. They can lose games. They're still the best team in the world, in my opinion.
Manchester United, Brentford. Simon, is there any chance you could just forget Manchester United exist until their next win? I mean, is this must win, Philippe? I feel like I've said that before. You know, we started with the Palace game going, this is a good run of games then. Palace, Galatasaray, Brentford, blah. Well, they've lost two of them in a row.
Yeah, I mean, the problem isn't every game a must-win game for Manchester United and has been for quite a while, I suppose it is. I really feel like that, what was her name? Margaret Dumont, you know, in the Marx Brothers films and Groucho Marx, because she was talking, and Groucho Marx asked her if she had been vaccinated with a gramophone needle because she was always saying the same thing. And I think we've gone over that so many times that I don't know what to add to that. I think it's more a question with Manchester United. It's very strange. It's a slow procession towards I don't know what.
It's just it's a burnt old sausage, Philippe, isn't it? We know what it is.
Yeah.
A burnt old sausage left in the oven overnight.
Yes.
Wolves Villa, still with you, Philippe. You wanted a word on the sleeve sponsor of Wolves and Josmar's latest investigation.
Yeah, I think that's important to say because I understand that Wolves are now looking into it more in depth, which is something perhaps they could have done beforehand. But you know, I'm involved with Josimar in an in-depth investigation into the links between sports betting operators, particularly illegal ones and so-called grey market ones and big football clubs. I've been doing that for 2.5 years. And one of those sponsors that I'm really interested in is 6686, which is not just the sleeve sponsor of Wolves, but also sponsors or is a partner of Monaco in France, of Wolfsburg in Bundesliga and Lazio in Italy. And I won't give all the background because that would be too complicated. Please have a look at the Josimar pieces on that. But what I will say is that in the course of that investigation, I realized to my utmost surprise that this particular sponsor, 6686 of Wolves, which is licensed by the Gambling Commission after a fashion under a different name, is actually showing or was actually showing live games from every single league that you can imagine in crystal quality HD on their website. You could even watch the Ukrainian second division. It's one of the biggest piracy operations I've ever come across, and which creates a problem, obviously, because how can you be the partner of a company which is already operating illegally in the Far East, by the way, nobody denies that, but which also pirating images from legitimate broadcasters from all over Europe and actually even from the Saudi League, if you can believe it, and proposing that to punters. 6686, I would love for the sake of balance to be able to tell you what they have to say about what I said, which are not accusations, but just facts. But unfortunately, nobody knows who they are because nobody can trace them and there's no address and there's no email and there's no phone number. It's not even a name. Mm. So
it's amazing these companies that are impossible to find and no one knows who they are can still get money from Premier League clubs to be, you know, have their names plastered on a shirt. You thought you'd have someone's number. new. I mean, what you're saying is...
Yes, well, you know, it's an agent who speaks to an agent who contacts the commercial department of a club, and they need the money, they want the money, they don't ask questions. They've got a kind of a UK license, which means nothing because it's not for that domain name, so, but it doesn't matter. It's so apparently it works all right, and they take the money, but the problem is that now Wolves have got to do something about it. And there are other clubs in England, by the way, who have to think about it, because Nottingham Forest and Leicester City also were partners of this brand, because it's not an operator, this brand called 6686.com. You can rest assured with the lawyers, by the way, Max, that everything I've said, and which you can read in more detail about on Yozibar, is absolutely fact-based and is not libelous or defamatory to anybody, including Wolverhampton Wanderers, who are now looking apparently into this particular deal.
Mm. Wolves in the Premier League are investigating, and despite it being quite difficult to track them down, Josimar has approached 6686 for comment. From, you know, 6686 to 777. It's like it's now an aeroplane, or just a pin number, a pin number podcast, isn't it? You've done a piece on 777, of course, looking to buy Everton, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. With my friend and colleague Paul Brown, again for Yozibar. We're very, very active at the moment. And then more doubts, basically, more questions asked about how can 777 partners who are multi-club owners, who are already in charge of Genoa in Italy, Vasco da Gama in Brazil, Standard Liège and so forth, can afford what they do and where their money comes from. And we've come up, I think, with some interesting facts about 777, but differently this time. I don't think I'm going to go into detail, Max, because I do not want producer Joel to have to go to the lawyers and have a through and through.
I don't want to be woken up in the middle
afternoon.
Of the night, mate. No, just read the piece. Read
exactly.
The piece.
Go to Yozimar and read the piece. There will be more coming, believe me, as well.
Follow Philippe on social media, and you can see all the pieces there. The UK and the Republic of Ireland will now bid unopposed for Euro 2028. After Turkey withdrew to focus a joint bid with Italy for Euro 2032, the 2030 World Cup appears to be a little bit more confusing. FIFA announced the following. FIFA World Cup in 2030 is set to unite the world in unique global celebration. That's good. Morocco, Portugal and Spain's joint bid is the sole candidate. But there'll be a centenary celebration and celebratory games to take place in Uruguay, Argentina and Paraguay, which you may or may not know are quite a long way away from Morocco, Portugal and Spain.
And from each other.
And from each other. Yeah. Right. They will all qualify, those six countries. But, you know, by 2030, I think there's 286 teams in the World Cup anyway, so that's okay. So it's a 48-team World Cup there, Philippe, am I right, by then? So, I mean, that's not great for the climate promises of FIFA is my first thought, and you tend to feel it will pave the way for Saudi Arabia 2034.
No, but that's the deal. The deal is that because you're going to give the 2030 World Cup to, you'll have a bit of Africa, obviously Morocco, which has been a long standing candidate for hosting the World Cup, so well done them to get it. Spain, Portugal, so you've got Europe and you've got Africa. Then obviously we'll have had the 2026 World Cup happening in the US, Mexico and Canada, so that's CONCACAF out of the way. And then you bring in CONMEBOL, which is the South American Confederation, by giving them a few group games and saying, that's it, you've had it. Now, okay, so now we're going to have an organizer, as FIFA said in the same statement. So we call on nations from the OFC, which is Oceania, good luck, guys, and the AFC, the Asian Confederation, to come forward. And lo and behold, who was ready to immediately say, me? Saudi Arabia, which already has on its LinkedIn page, which I really recommend. Everybody should be subscribed to this one. It's fantastic. They've already got all the promotional films showed. They've declared their candidacy. They already have the support of various people. I think Kuwait and Bahrain have declared in favor. Yeah, this is fantastic. So Saudi Arabia will have, which is hosting, by the way, the FIFA Club World Cup in a few months' time, will have the 2034 World Cup. And that is the really important message of the day. And the thing is that it's so blatant that all we're going to do is to say, you know what, it's FIFA. We should get used to that. We're used to that. When actually what we should be doing is take the pitchforks and go to FIFA Strasse and let them know what we think about the way they do to football and the way they take their decisions.
FIFA released the bid timeline for the 2034 tournament early on Thursday morning. This is The Guardian's reporting, setting a deadline of the 31st of October for potential bids to confirm their interest. Football Australia, which of course put on a very good Women's World Cup in New Zealand, state and federal governments and potential Asian co-hosts have been given just 25 days by FIFA to decide whether they'll bid for the 2034 Men's World Cup. A thumbs up from Philippe. The tight timeline was revealed on the same day an intention to host the tournament was announced by Saudi Arabia, which received the backing of Asia's most powerful football administrator. Football Australia's chief executive, James Johnson, said his organisation is, quote, exploring the possibility of a 2034 bid. So still up in the air.
Yeah.
World Cup in Melbourne. I mean, bring it on.
That would be fantastic. Actually, would love it.
Will says, I love the pod. I have a question for Philippe. It's been quite heavy. Philippe, part three. I hope that's okay, Nikki. I see Mark chuckling away. I love the pod, says Will. I have a question for Philippe. I have recently started dating a French girl. I now want to start supporting a French team. She is from Paris, and I don't fancy that at all. If he could recommend any team I can try and form a connection with, preferably near Paris, I would love that. Keep up the good work. You've really helped me through some seriously tough times. Glad to hear it, Will. Over to you, Philippe. Who are the good guys?
I would have said until recently Red Star, but they now belong to 777, so let's forget about them. I would say you're not very far. You're direct from Paris. You're direct on the train line to Le Havre. Le Havre is the oldest French club. It was founded in 1872. It's back in Ligue 1. It's a lovely city. It's a modern city, brand new city, but the architecture is astonishing. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, by the way. It's by the sea, so there's loads of nice oysters from nearby farms, and it's the club I've supported since I was born.
And a ferry. You can get a ferry, can't you, Philippe, as well?
And you can get the ferry, but the ferry is for people who come from Portsmouth and want to go to a nice place, not the other way around. And it's a great city. It's a great club. It's the oldest French club, and it's only like 1 hour and 40 minutes from Paris when the trains are on time, which is not very often at the moment. Well, 2 hours, let's say. So, Le Havre Athletic Club, just down the road for you.
What's Pompey ever done to you, Philippe, is my question.
Nothing. I was being needlessly facetious. Yeah. And good luck, Pompey. Well done, Pompey.
They're doing very well. They're doing very well in League One at the moment.
Exactly.
We'll talk about them on the EFL pod on Tuesday. Yeah, that'll do for today. Thank you, Nikki.
Thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Philippe.
Thank you, Max.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens. Back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.